Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good evening. Welcome to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Tonight, as normal or as usual, we have an important show, and I'll just put it out there just like that. We are going to talk to author Bryn Tannehill, and Bryn has written a brand new book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Being Trans But Were Afraid to Ask. And I think this is an important book because I think there are a lot of people, many, many people, who don't understand what being transgender is all about. It is coming more and more in the news. They are afraid to ask people because they really want to be understanding. They want to be there and understand basic principles, but there are so many questions that they have, and quite frankly, they are afraid to ask because in their ignorance, they may end up offending somebody. So I think this book is incredibly useful. And by extrapolation, I think this show tonight is very important because we're going to go through a lot of the content and the ideas that Bryn has written about, and we hope to share them with you. So if people can't get their hands on the book, which they absolutely should, they can listen to this podcast and get a heads up on what they're going to read. With that, I want to bring on my co-host, the esteemed journalist, Brody Levesque. Brody, good evening.
Good evening, Rob, and good evening to our listeners. It has been
so, Brody, before we get to Bryn, let's hear what news stories are out there before we get to Bryn.
It's been tumultuous again covering the, you know, administration, especially with today's guilty plea in federal court by Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen. Those of us that have been picking through the plea bargain or plea agreement, I should say, that Cohen made with the special counsel. Let's just say at this point, it does not bode well for the Trump administration. I'd also like to point out that on Saturday will be the 30th anniversary of World AIDS Day, where we recognize, the horrible cost and the ongoing struggle with HIV/AIDS. And so I would remind everyone to please kindly commemorate Saturday with a red ribbon or, you know, a moment of silence or whatever you deem appropriate. But it is truly a day that, you know, needs to be marked. This past week, of course, on the 27th, was the 40th anniversary of the political assassinations of San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and San Francisco District 5 Supervisor Harvey Milk. They were both killed at City Hall by a former San Francisco supervisor, Dan White. One of the guests on our show, actually we've got a couple of people on the show, but one of our guests was Dan Nicoletta, who actually worked for Harvey Milk in the gastrocnemius store and knew him well. It's looking back at four decades, many of the things that Harvey wanted to see accomplished, you know, we're still not there. And it's one of the things, which is kind of a sense of irony. Harvey had always talked about making sure that, you know, the gay people came out and that they were heard and things like that. Today, Media Matters editor-at-large Parker Malloy was writing in the New York Times in an op-ed the following, and we'll talk to Bryn about this too. Trans people are less likely to speak up if they know that they're going to be constantly told that they don't exist. And it's not just that. It's looking at the other segments, unfortunately and sadly, of the population. As we go into celebrating World AIDS Day on Saturday, once again this year, Vice President Michael Pence was put in charge of the celebrations by the White House. Things how the President, the First Lady, and the official party are in Argentina for the G20 summit this weekend. And once again, Pence didn't mention, gays at all. It's back to the old erasure thing. It really is one of those things where, and I say this more so not to our audience, because I think in many ways that's kind of like preaching to the choir, but I think that anybody that's listening to this broadcast, people that will be listening to this broadcast, particularly since this is such a critical topic, I'd like to point out that at the end of the day, this has to do with humanity and human beings. And this idea that you can put people in boxes and discriminate or subjugate them based on flawed constructs, most of which are predicated on religious beliefs, I'm sorry, but, we're in the 21st century, folks, and I think it's time we got past that. And with that, I'll throw it back to you, Rob.
Yeah, and I would just one comment. I think there's a perverse poetry in having Mike Pence be the person to be involved with World AIDS Day on the part of this administration. And I say that because his silence on the effect that this has had on gay people, gay men in particular, actually is a weird, perverted throwback from the GOP of the 1980s and Ronald Reagan, who could not even say the name of the disease for many years while so many of our people died. So in a certain sense, their brand of celebrating World AIDS Day is to celebrate the guilty silence that they perpetrated on us back then, which did nothing but help spread the disease and give it even more power than it already had, and to take its toll. So, seriously,
I don't disagree.
Seriously, fuck them. But they've kept themselves consistent. Let's put it that way.
Well, I think it's kind of important, and now that you've mentioned that, I mean, today. The Guardian, which is one of the dailies in the United Kingdom, a member of Parliament stood up, Lloyd Russell Moyle, and he in a speech to Commons, he revealed that he's HIV positive, and the whole speech in Commons was about the fact that the entire thing is just so. Absolutely deeply, misunderstood. On a private note, 30 years ago, not tomorrow or Saturday the 1st, but towards the middle of the month, I lost my best friend to AIDS. And he was a person that was critically important. As a matter of fact, he was the reason I actually came to the United States initially. He taught me a lot of things. I think the thing that he taught me the most was how much poetry needed to be a part of daily life. I mean, he could literally quote Walt Whitman and Oscar Wilde with, gleeful abandon. And I guess juxtapositioning against that, as you know, Rob, and some of the folks that follow me on Facebook and Twitter know, I am honored to know a young Welsh poet who's just written his first book, Visceral, and it's R.J. Archipulf, and R.J., he's been biting in the United Kingdom against the ban on gay men donating blood. And, RJ and a lot of the other activists on the ground, and including here in the United States, Mark King, who's been on our show here, they're all rewriting the narrative of the stigma surrounding, seropositivity. And I think this is really critically important. But moving forward, I mean, I'm with you. I don't have much use for the Pences of this world.
Yeah. No, I don't think I don't think. Well, I know I don't. I know you don't. And I am going to guess that our special guest tonight, Bryn, doesn't either. And with that, we'll transition over to Bryn, and we'll talk about everything you ever wanted to know about being trans, but were afraid to ask. Bryn, welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thank you for having me on again.
Oh, our pleasure. Anytime you are in your seat, you get that seat anytime your heart desires.
Much appreciated. And great segue on Pence, because erasing the LGBT community is nothing new. It was being done in the 80s to the gay man during the AIDS crisis, and it's being done to the trans community now, and they're trying to bring back erasing the gay community again. And it's kind of, I'm trying to look for a more appalling word than appalling, but I'm sort of failing at the moment.
Well, I do want to make one comment out, Bryn, on what you just said, too. For those members of the LGBT community and my fellow gay men, that if you don't get what is happening to our trans brothers and sisters now, shame on you. Because we've been through it. We know the pain of it. And it is our turn to be the allies. So anyway, my little commercial message on that. Bryn, but you've written a book, and I'm very excited about it. Tell us what inspired that.
So kind of a long story, and I'll cut it down a bit here, but when I first started writing for outlets, it was basically as responses to things that came up in the cultural conversation, things that I saw in comments on articles about trans people, things that were in response to articles by the right wing, responses to myths and misconceptions about transgender people. A lot of them started out as addressing things about transgender youth that people didn't know, or things about transgender or parents of transgender youth that people didn't know. And over time, I built up this entire body of writing. And about 3 years ago, people started to ask me, why don't you write a book? And I'm like, well, I don't know what to make it about. Because I've written a little bit about trans people in athletics, and I've written about medicine and mental health, and I've written about myths, and I've written about dating, and trans people in the media, and law, and politics, and religion. I've just written about whatever seemed interesting and underserved by people taking a serious scholarly look at it. And it took me a solid 6 months to realize that why not do the Seinfeld thing and make a book that isn't about nothing, but make a book that's about everything and try and cover all of it and see if that would cover the entire spectrum of the trans experience. And as I started putting it together, I realized that it covered a huge array of topics, and that was kind of going to work because nobody had ever done before. Nobody had ever tackled the trans experience in such a holistic way.
That, I think, go ahead, Brody.
No, I think that, you know, tonight we have a much larger audience than we normally do, Bryn. And for those that don't know you as well as Rob and I do, particularly myself, you know, your resume is pretty impressive. Former helicopter pilot, naval officer, Annapolis graduate, analyst for one of the Beltway Bandit think tanks. So why don't you give us just a little brief bio on you? Because but surprisingly enough, there are actually going to be people that don't know who you are, and I think I'd just rather have you tell us who you are. I know who you are, but why don't you tell the audience who you are?
So I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, near Luke Air Force Base. I always wanted to be a pilot. I went to the Naval Academy, graduated in 97, ended up flying helicopters and maritime patrol aircraft. I did 4 deployments with the U.S. Navy, most of them into the Persian Gulf and the Middle East. After that, I got my degree, my master's degree in operations research from the Air Force Institute of Technology. In 2010, I got out of the reserves and started transitioning. And once I transitioned, I was in the inactive reserves, and I wanted to try and find, create the conditions under which I could get back in and finish out my career. And that's how I got involved in the transmilitary movement in kind of its earliest phases, right as Don't Ask, Don't Tell was winding down and as the movement was trying to figure out what to do next. And over that time, I've been the director of advocacy for SPARTA, the world's largest transmilitary organization. We have over 1,000 members who are mostly active duty, guard and reserve service members. I worked at the TransUnited Fund with Equality Ohio. I've continued to hold down a job in defense industry, lobbying for greater access to health care within industry. At that same time, I've written hundreds of articles with various outlets, including The Advocate and LGBTQ Nation, Billerico Project, Huffington Post, New York Times, Salon, Slate, yada, yada, yada. And that's where the material for my book came from originally. And at this point, I, like you said, I work at a think tank in the D.C. area, and I'm married and 3 kids and a white picket fence and a dog that a cat that barfs on people's shoes, you know, some American dream.
The American dream, totally. Bryn, in putting together the book, you start out with Trans 101, giving people kind of an update primer on understanding. Can you give us a little bit of a synopsis of what a Trans 101 entails and what people should understand from it?
So Trans 101 starts with the very basics of what is transgender, what fits under the transgender umbrella, what does transgender mean, what does assigned at birth mean, what does intersex mean, what kinds of terms are used, like hermaphrodite is an archaic and offensive term for an intersex person, difference between transgender and transsexual. Lots of definitions to get people to be able to go with the rest of the book, what transgender and cisgender means, and it's basically the two opposite terms for person who identifies with the gender with which they're born and someone who doesn't, i.e. transgender. And it goes through that and gives people kind of the vocabulary to engage with the rest of the book. And then the second half of the first chapter is how to engage with transgender people. What are kind of the cultural mores that come with being a transgender person? Like, don't ask to see old pictures of them before transition. Don't ask about their names before transition unless it's offered. Don't ask about what kind of surgeries they've had unless it's something that the trans person wants to volunteer. And a lot of this, when you step back and think about it, is common sense. I don't ask you about the history of your junk. So why should you ask me, right? And when giving people context to understand, oh, well, here's where that cultural moray came from. Here's where why this is kind of awkward or offensive, to kind of help people understand this is what it is. But there's also a reason why transgender people have these feelings about interactions and where the language has come from. So it essentially gives people the ability to speak the language, and to engage with the rest of the book.
Bryn, let me talk to you for a second about what you and I have discussed many, many times, and that's what we call the ick factor coupled with gender dysphoria, and explain to the audience why the perceptions and the conflation of different things is really not a healthy way to approach this. I think the number one thing being, of course, that, and we fight with the right about this all the time, is, you know, they conflate sexual orientation and gender identity, and they've melded it into, you know, this horrid thing, which naturally leads to the unpleasant discussions we have with them over them saying that, you know, we're going to have a bunch of, you know, men wearing women's dresses in a little girl's room molesting a little girl crap as one of those things. But let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about, you know, the understanding, because things have, even within the medical community, have changed on gender dysphoria and how they're viewing it, what they're looking at. As you know, there was a discussion touched off by another New York Times op-ed earlier in the week about surgical procedures, which led to, you know, what is, you know, going to be the best suited thing for gender identity. So let's talk about that a little bit.
So there's a lot to unpack there. So as a starting point, gender identity is who you see yourself as with regards to your gender. And sexual orientation is who you are attracted to, whether it be men, women, neither, both, in between. So one is a matter of attraction, one is a matter of identity. And a lot of people on the right don't get that. So something I've been seeing in the past few days on Twitter is a lot of right-wingers with regards to transgender children saying, these children don't have any understanding of sexuality. Well, no, they don't. But they do understand who they are and what their gender is. And there's research to show that transgender youth are as secure in their gender identity as cisgender youth. So that's one aspect of it. Then you talk about the ick factor. And to give some context, the ick factor for trans people is kind of the same kind of ick factor that was applied to the thought of gay men having sex, right? Except for trans people, it's, you know, bottom surgery, really. And that just kind of squicks people out and gets this visceral, you know, reaction that gets people to draw back rather than engaging with the persons themselves and only engaging with what they imagine about this person's genitals and what they've done with them. And that's not healthy. And unfortunately, it's kind of the same thing that what's being done to transgender people is what was being done to gay men, you know, 20 years ago with, oh, you know, how can you have these people around when they do that? And that's, you know, it's drawing from an old playbook. So there is that. And then going on to Andrea Long Chu's article in the New York Times, she was speaking for herself. There is a reason why the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, every major medical and mental health organization in the United States have a policy position that transition-related care is medically necessary, that is beneficial to transgender patients, and that access to that care should not be denied for either political, religious, or insurance reasons. And that's kind of where the article went off the deep end, is that it provided misinformation about gender confirmation surgery and what a post-operative care for a vaginoplasty entails, and how functional it is, and how much does transition-related care benefit transgender people. And you can go to the What We Know project at Cornell University, and 93% of the studies that looked at transition-related care for transgender people found that it provides a significant benefit to quality of life. And that is why it is the medical standard. And if you want, we can go a little bit into how medical and mental health has view of transgender people has changed over the past few years, past half decade or so.
I think that's important. I'm just going to walk back into something you just said. My dear friend Julia Scotti, who is a comedian, she's from Whiting, New Jersey, is trans. As a comedian and a comic, she will actually get up on stage and she cracks jokes about, you know, penis guillotines. And she says invariably she gets a few members of the audience, predominantly male, who involuntarily cross their legs and start doing other things. I think the problem, and she does a really good job. If you have to ever get a chance to listen to her routine, she'll slay you. But one of the things that Julie and I talked about, and this was in honest sincerity, was that it seems that a lot of times on the right there is such a disconnect in terms of understanding, you know, the identity part of it and grabbing on to, you know, the embracing of oneself as an individual within the gender versus this perception that the right has, you know, and again, conflating, okay, sexual orientation with gender identity, and the two are completely polar opposites. So anyway, Rob?
Brent, I had a different question, but I do want you to go into what you just brought up in terms of the, you know, how the medical profession has evolved per se, or, you know, their historical and their current viewpoint.
So the big thing to note is that just like sexual orientation, medical science has come around with the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 5, which is kind of the Bible of the American Psychiatric Association for making diagnoses, is that being transgender is not a mental illness by definition. It is only the distress that comes with gender dysphoria that is an illness. So when you have a transgender person who is perfectly healthy, happy, adjusted, there is nothing to diagnose at that point. And this is kind of the same way that they started depathologizing homosexuality in 1972, except they changed it at that time to, well, being gay isn't a mental disorder, but distress over it is. And over time, they phase that out. And we're seeing kind of the same arc of history on medical diagnosis and psychiatric diagnosis for transgender people. And over time, we're seeing that with the ICD-11, which is going to essentially take out most of the diagnoses of being transgender and just make them Z-notes in order to allow people to get medical care for it, treating it mostly as a medical issue rather than a psychiatric one.
Very, very important. Brent, I want to switch a little bit. I'm a parent like you are, and I know as my sons have grown up and when they were little, I sort of deviated away from anything really genderizing clothes or, you know, it's like I didn't want to impact them with, you know, oh, that looks like a boy's pair of pants, or oh, that looks like a girl's pair of pants, and, you know, that type of thing. And so that's when it comes to the gender identity, and you address this in the book really well. So I'm going to ask you the question that you posed and discuss this kind of under in the book and get your response. Is gender purely a social construct, or is it biological?
And the answer is a kind of unsatisfying one, but it's both. And this is kind of one of those gotcha moments where the right tries to say, well, which one is it? Can you decide? And the answer is, like I said, both. And you can demonstrate that there are elements for either. For example, pink and blue, neither one is inherently gendered. And in fact, how we regard the gender of those two colors has flipped in the past 100 years in terms of what clothing you would put a baby in. It used to be that boys were supposed to be in pink. You can see this in, Lady and the Tramp, a Disney movie, where they tried to capture 1910-ish America, right? The baby boy was in pink. Conversely, there are very, very strong indications that one's internal sense of gender is based off of biology, and we're having more and more studies showing this new field of oligogenics, which is related to gene development. We're seeing it with epigenetics, which is gene expression. We're seeing in combinations of genes. We're seeing it in terms of environmental factors that could be endocrine disrupting chemicals. All sorts of things affect gender identity, but what doesn't affect gender identity is anything that your parents do to you after you're born, right? This is like being gay. Your parents didn't make you gay. Your parents don't make you trans, right? And this is something that we're coming to understand better and better now, and we're having better and better evidence. And just like a reparative therapy on gay people, reparative therapy on transgender people never worked. They did all the same. They treated transgender people the same way they treated gay people back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with electroshocks and psychic driving and MK Ultra type stuff and talk theory and cognitive behavioral therapy and play therapy and everything. Everything that they ever tried on gay men, they tried on transgender women, and it had just as much success, which is to say none. So what is it social? Is it nature? A little bit of both, but I would say that the best way to think of it is that how we choose to express our gender has strong social influences.
Brim, I'm going to keep going with that thought for just a second. And the reason I'm going to is because I happen to know that one of our listeners tonight is an old dear friend listening from Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, a Native American. They use the pronouns they and their. And one of the things that they wanted me to ask you specifically, as you know, the Aboriginals of the First Nations had between anywhere from 3 to 5 genders that they recognized. And then, of course, that was more or less eradicated by the Christian missionaries, first mm-hmm. with the Catholicism coming up with the conquistadores and the Jesuit fathers and the Franciscan fathers, and then, of course, later by the, you know, Pentecostal, evangelical, and mainstream moving out from east to west. So here's the question. Do you think that there's going to be a time culturally that the United States is going to be able to recognize what the Native Aboriginals have known for a very long time, and that is that there is just more than one gender?
And I think the United States is going to get dragged kicking and screaming into what is essentially human nature, that transgender people have always existed across cultures and across time, and that gender is a spectrum that experience differently based on who they are. So to give further examples, you mentioned, you know, the French, when they started taking over and spreading Catholicism in Canada, called them the Bardiche. In the Pacific Islands, the Fa'afine are a third gender, and it's not a big deal. We look at the Katoy of Thailand, and then you have the Hijra of India and Pakistan, who are also treated as a third gender, and the role of the Hijra is built right into Hinduism. Beyond that, you can find references in the Kama Sutra, which dates to 1500 BC, roughly, which describes having sex, how to have sex with a Hijra. So human cultures have always had transgender and gender variant and third gender people. Even in Europe, we found ancient bones buried with funeral rites that were the opposite gender that their sex was. We found Viking women who were buried with full male accoutrements, shields, chainmail, swords, and the like, who were apparently raiding captains. So there have even been third gender and gender non-binary and possibly even transgender expressions even within Europe. It's just within Western culture that has kind of worked very hard to stomp it out. And I think what we're seeing right now is a begrudging recognition that transgender people have always been around and they've always been here, and that this is just a natural way for human beings to experience and express gender.
Bryn, I want to take a moment just to point out, because we are actually getting a number of callers calling in, and so I just want to reach out to the callers that are trying to get through, that unfortunately tonight we do not have time to do a Q&A or a comment and a session on this show. So I would encourage people to join the group Rated LGBT on Facebook, and you can put your comments or questions there. Also, you can follow me on Twitter and ask questions there as well. And my handle on Twitter is @JandJDad, and we'll be happy to bring up topics that way. But tonight we have enough just with us monkeys in this little barrel ourselves. Bryn, I wanted to ask you, because you have a chapter on dating in your book, and I heard a podcast mm-hmm. with a transgender individual who addressed dating, although she did it really from her own perspective and her own rules with men she went out with. And it was very fun and lighthearted, and it was informative, but very, very narrow. The one thing I loved in your book was how you really packed it with research and in a much broader sense. Can you give us a high level view of what are the high points that should be thought of in terms of a transgender person dating?
So some of the big ticket items are, it's difficult dating as a transgender person, even if you have massive amounts of passing privilege. There's been a bunch of studies done relatively recently that show that there's a lot of bias against transgender people, that people, if they even think somebody's transgender, even if they're not, will reject them on Tinder, or that the number, the percentage of even LGBT or LGB people who are willing to date a transgender person is really low, and the number of straight and cisgender people who are willing to date a transgender person is very low. So it's really, really tough to start with. Then you have the entire issue of, for a lot of transgender people, they have not had bottom surgery. And how do you deal with that? And when do you talk about that? And when do you bring it up? And when do you discuss that within dating? And when do you bring up the fact that you're trans? And there are no simple and easy answers to that, because disclosing anything right up front can make it impossible to go forward at all, even just building a, hey, how are you doing? Let's talk, level of relationship. But failure to disclose can also put a transgender person at great risk of violence, and that's also very dangerous. So you're caught in this nasty catch-22 of, if I tell up front, I'm not going to get any interest, but if I don't tell up front, I'm risking violence. And this is kind of a nasty situation for transgender people, and it's also why you see a lot of times, I know a lot of transgender people who end up dating other transgender people.
Actually, I have a pair of young people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, actually Broken Arrow, Aaron Andrews and Katie Rainhill, and they were actually young trans youths of note, and their story actually went national, and they dated each other initially, and now they both have their own relationships. Aaron was female to male. Katie was male to female. Which brings me to my next question point, kind of let's talk about this a little bit, Brent. There's a young activist in the Houston, Texas area. His name is Landon Ritchie. I'm going to give Landon a shout out. He is a young trans activist, an amazing young artist, writer, and he is very much a civil rights advocate. And he puts himself out there. And, of course, he's in Texas, of all places. My good friend Aiden Bowling, who's been a longtime trans activist, and he lives up with his wife in Oregon. In fact, they just had a little baby. Congratulations. Both of them are very visible, and there's an age difference. Aiden, of course, is in his mid-30s. Landon, I believe, just turned 16. What do you say and how do you say? I mean, the younger generation seem to be a little bit more adept at it. You know, kids like Landon are putting themselves out there, but there's still a lot of unease, for the trans kids and the youth kids. And in writing a book and doing the research and talking about this, and I'm addressing this because I know these kids. Aaron and I still keep in touch, and Katie and all the rest of them. And on one sense, Brim, they are cutting edge and ahead of the crowd and ahead of the curve. But on the other sense, you know, there's still inherent built-in dangers for them, and there's still pitfalls and things that they have to look out for. Let's talk about that for a minute.
So trans youth are at the forefront of things. They are the number one target for the religious right. They are the number one target for litigation right now, to the ADF filing lots and lots of lawsuits saying that the mere presence of a transgender student, or the possibility of sharing a bathroom with a transgender student, violates the inherent civil rights of cisgender students and creates a hostile environment. Now, contrast that with my own kids. The two older ones who are in junior high and high school. And I've asked them about, are there transgender kids at your schools? Yeah. What's the reaction? People don't care. And that's our little blue, that's our little blue bubble to some extent. But that's what I also hear from other parents of trans youth, is that the kids don't care. It's the adults that are absolutely out of their minds. And we just saw a video posted today on Facebook of this transgender girl in a bathroom where the school authorities pry open the door as she is sitting on the toilet peeing, and drag her out of the bathroom after they throw the door open with her underwear down. And this is just kind of like, wow, people are having this much of a reaction to a trans kid in the bathroom. And it's the adults. It's not the kids that are throwing a fit. But this is a very perilous environment for them, because we're starting to see a shift in the right-wing narrative on trans youth, that trans youth are somehow a contagion, and that their trans kids are co-opting other kids and sucking them in. And it's kind of the exact same predator myth that was used against gay men, that, you know, that they would draw in victims and prey on kids and convert them. And we know that's idiocy. We know exactly how disgusting that narrative is. But now we're starting to see the religious right and the TERFs in the UK start to use that same argument about kids and transgender teens. And that's very dangerous, because it incites stochastic violence. These are kids. At the end of the day, they're still kids. And they need adults to protect them, not be attacking them.
Right. I want to emphasize, because I've asked my kids the exact same question and gotten the exact same answer that you did. It's, you know, they have transgender friends, and what's the big deal? It's no big deal. And, you know, it's the adults. It's the adults. Bryn, one of the things in the title of your book, you talk about, but we're afraid to ask. And one of the areas that a lot of people are incredibly curious about, and it is incredibly none of their business, but they are incredibly curious about it anyway, and it would be fall under the category they're afraid to ask. What is it about the surgeries? What are you talk about a lot of the myths and the realities of the surgeries involved with being transgender. Can you give us a highlight of those?
Well, so the surgery itself, if you want a description of exactly how it's done, there's some absolutely fantastic gory videos you can find on YouTube or on surgeons' websites if you really want to watch the surgery itself. I really don't need to. but I've done enough medevacs. I don't need it. But a lot of the misconceptions about the surgery are about the functionality afterwards, whether or not you can have an orgasm. Yes, you can. You have penetrative sex. Yes. Is it an open wound? No, it's not an open wound. It's basically like having a vaginal canal, but no cervix and uterus. It's basically a blind pouch. That it doesn't have a super duper long recovery time, that the maintenance of it is not that great. After the first year, it's kind of once every few days for 20 minutes. No, it won't heal shut. It just gets tighter. And then part of the other is, but we're afraid to ask, is sex, right? And the answer to that is a little bit unsatisfying, because transgender people are still people. They're human. The body parts that they come with are body parts that roughly half the population has, regardless of sex. Anything that you can do with that body part, everybody else can too. So if you ask, do transgender people do, you know, X with their body parts, the answer is, well, yes, because people can do that. So there is the chapter on, or the section on sex is a little bit unsatisfying, because you don't need to go into every single thing that people can do, because you can answer the question simply by asking, is this something that people can do with their body parts? Then yes, there's probably straight people, gay people, trans people who are doing it. I don't really need to dive into the purient details to list all of them, because for God's sakes, the internet is for porn, okay?
I will make one point, and this cannot be said enough to people who have, as Brody described earlier, the ick factor when it comes to same gender, whether it's same from transgender or whatever relations. Whatever sex act that you as a conservative person are worried about a transgender person having, a gay person having, a lesbian person having, a bisexual person having, straight people have those sex acts more than anyone else, period, bar none. They own it. You know, it's like it's all there. So get over it. And Brody?
I'm
just waiting for, someone to come along. Maybe, Bryn, you'll be it to write, we've had, the joy of sex, we've had the joy of gay sex. Some moron's going to write the joy of trans sex. Yeah, I've been an ally of the trans community for probably well over 30-plus years. And the one thing that, and this is an important discussion. I mean, a lot of people are probably doing the cringe factor, but I don't do the cringe factor with this, especially since, Bryn, you're a parent, Rob, you're a parent, I'm a parent. We've all had the talk. And this really focuses in on the biggest problem and the biggest opposition, or the, I think, just ground zero for the ick factor. The right, particularly the Christian right, okay, are screaming at the top of their lungs about the whole reproduction thing. None of them, and I mean this sincerely, I have yet to see any of them acknowledge, okay, that people sometimes, do the beast with two backs just because they're showing intimacy and for the hell of it. And it's that hang-up that seems to be able to carry its way over, okay, to, just the entire rest of it. I have yet to see anyone, and I'm probably no different, and Rob, I'm sure you're not, and Bryn, you're female, but you're probably, Rob and I on this one in terms of the way we look at it. But, this is an act of intimacy when we're talking about sex and when we're talking about doing the nasty, okay? This isn't about, it's about an expression of a person's individuality when they are expressing love. Or in some cases, it's recreational and we're all there because we're having a good time. Anyway, Bryn, so looking at the book itself for just a second, what's your principal goal with the book? I mean, you've authored all sorts of, just brilliant pieces and articles and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you're, a hell of an analyst. But what's your basic message? Why this book? Why now? I mean, there's got to be a motivation for you to put this out there, because let's face it, judging from the fact that Rob is already, fields off phone calls, and I kind of knew this show was going to do that. Talk to us about the book. Why? Just why?
Because somebody on the internet is wrong. But yes.
Okay. Well, I'll take that one. All right.
Tell me that's not true. Oh my God.
It's an XKCD cartoon that's kind of hanging on my wall at my office as kind of. Is a joke about my motivation, but there is so much bad information out there, and the people putting out the bad information have so much money. They have so much time. They have the ability, like the Heritage Foundation, to put people on staff who their entire job is to get paid $100,000+ a year to produce anti-trans papers and theses and material that is somewhere between pseudoscience and hoaxes and gobbledygook to basically try and slap a scientific veneer on top of bigotry. And the trans community has never had a book like this to explain themselves to a mass market to counter all of these narratives and this bad information and this twisting and distortion of science. At this point, the medical debate on access to care for transgender people is essentially over. But unlike the climate change, where 97% of the papers are in support of anthropogenic climate change. What we're seeing with transgender issues is that of the books being put out there to mass audiences, it's almost inverted from what the science is saying in terms of just the sheer volume of anti-trans stuff being put out there. And I wanted to do what I could from my position to try and counter that. Now, I can't do it by myself, but it was necessary to put the information out there on so many different topics to at least create a baseline of truth and academic rigor for a mass market, not in academic papers.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, of course, you know, and you're referencing our dear friend Ryan T. Anderson and his pseudoscience over at the Heritage Foundation.
I wasn't going to give him publicity.
Hateful book that he wrote. But, well, I mean, you know, I'm a journalist, so for me it's not giving him publicity. It's airing the fact that this person is out there spreading lies, deceptions about the trans community. He's spreading, you know, it's pseudoscience and none of it makes, you know, it's wrong, as you said. And I think that, you know, it is time, you know, that we call these people on that. And I'm very glad, you know, that the book is out there. In many ways, the problem I have with a lot of these people is like the old tale of the scorpion and the frog. The scorpion needs to get to the other side of the flooded riverbank, and the frog isn't willing to give him a ride because he's a scorpion, and he says, well, I can't give you a ride because you're gonna sting me. And the scorpion says, oh, no, I would never do that. And, you know, the frog acquiesces. They swim across the river, and just before they get to the other shore, what does the scorpion do? He stings him. And the frog, as he's dying, asks him, well, why did you do that? And the scorpion says, because I'm a scorpion. Anyway, Rob.
thanks, Brody, for that. Bryn, we've touched on a lot of points from the book that are pretty poignant. We're winding down our time here, so I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell us, of all the things that you've written about and touched on in the book, what are some of the important points that we haven't yet discussed that you want to make sure people know about?
So the thing that we really, one of the things that we haven't touched or only briefly touched on was that reparative therapy, the idea that, well, why don't you just, you know, fix their minds and make them not trans rather than trying to change their bodies. That's been the number one talking point of the religious right. And it's basically an endorsement of reparative therapy. And I can say with 100% certainty, no one has ever definitively and scientifically proven in a clinical environment that you can make a person not transgender, that the entire premise of most of the anti-transgender talking points out there is fundamentally wrong, it's unscientific, and it is not supported by anything out there ever, that it is the same snake oil they were selling in 1997 and 1998 when the ex-gay movement was trying very, very hard to sell ex-gay therapy to the nation as a way for gay men to not be gay and not get HIV and not, you know, whatever, right? As they're using the same snake oil, the same methods, the same therapies, the same, and I say therapies with quotes around them, the same way to try and convert, closet, cure, or kill a group of people. And this time it's transgender people. And if you go to the last chapter of my book, there's actually three pages of like bullet point takeaways with citations. And if you really, really want the bottom line up front, go to the last chapter and read that last section. And that's like the, here's the things that I want you to know. Here are the things that you've got to take away from this book.
And I've got two things going on in my head at once here. Sorry. One other thing, Bryn, though, I would like you to mention, and one is where we can find the book, where people can buy the book.
So you can get it from Jessica Kingsley Publishers, jkp.com. You can also get it from Amazon.com. You can get it from Barnes & Noble. There are a number of used book sellers already on Amazon that are selling it, but it's available through Amazon Prime, and you can also get it on Kindle and in paperback.
Excellent. I did want to go further without having people get that information so they know where to find it. But the one other topic that also stood out for me was your discussion about the myths around transgender suicide. Can you give us a minute on that?
So one of the biggest things, some of the biggest myths out there is that transition makes people more likely to commit suicide. And the researcher who did the study that they always cite looked suicide rates for people who had already transitioned. It didn't look at non-transitioning transgender people. It only looked versus the general population. And what she found was that for people in transgender people who were living through the AIDS crisis in the 80s had a really high suicide rate. And then after 1989, the suicide rates dropped way off and weren't statistically different from the rest of the population. But whenever the religious right tries to talk about suicide, they point to the study. If they see it makes people commit suicide, it's like, no, we have no control group in that. The author says you can't use it for that purpose. And for the cohort after 1989, the suicide rates aren't any different. This was also people in Sweden. But the other thing about suicide is that we have studied what factors make it more likely for people to commit suicide when they're trans. And the things that seem to keep popping up over and over again after decades of study are they being mistreated? Are they homeless? Have they lost their jobs? They have access to care? Have they been beaten? Have they been raped? Have they been kicked out by their families? All of these things, this mistreatment, these hardships in life, this social stigma, this minority stress contribute to suicide risk. And because transgender people suffer from so much stigma and so much minority stress, these are the reasons why that we see the overall higher suicide rates for transgender people, because this is rough. And somebody who read my book looked through and said, wow, well, you keep telling us how bad things are for transgender people. And that's one of the points that people have to understand, that this is a very, very difficult culture for transgender people to navigate.
And you know what? I think you just summed it up perfectly. I think that point, the last point you made, is one that I really want people to sit with. And we who are allies and advocates need to take responsibility for this world and make it not such a tough road and make it better. And with this book, I think you've done an enormous thing in helping broaden that understanding. So, Brynn, I want to thank you so much, as always, for being our guest. Fantastic. The book is fantastic. People listening, go buy this, give it away for Christmas, put it in the hands of people who need to understand and who have questions. It is the perfect vehicle for that. Brody, I want to thank you as always. Your expertise, your knowledge, your professionalism, outstanding, and your partnership is priceless. I want to thank our listeners for listening in. We will be back again next week at the same bat time, same bat channel. Also, don't forget about Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com on Saturday, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Another show with great LGBT topics, and we'd love for you to listen to that too. So for our team here, I'm going to say good night. Thank you again for listening, and we look forward to sharing more with you again next week.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.